Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Some 100 generations have passed since Gotama, the sage of the Sakyans, the Tathagata, the Scone One, 80 years of age, announced that he would soon depart from the world. The Buddha's foremost disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, had already passed away. The Fortunate One asked his assistant, Ananda, to summon all of the monastics living near Vaisali to meet so that he could make his prophecy public. When they had convened, he spoke these words, "Bhikkhus, I've now taught you things that I have directly known. These you should thoroughly learn and maintain in being, develop, and constantly put into effect so that this holy life may endure long. You should do so for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the good and welfare and happiness of gods and men. Now, monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on untiringly." Nibbana, which in Sanskrit is nirvana, is awakening, and final nibbana is complete release from the conventional existence at death of the body. In the 45 years since his awakening, the Buddha had realized the goals he had set for himself when he had vowed that he would not leave the world until the monks, nuns, laymen, followers, laywomen followers, my disciples are wise, disciplined, perfectly confident, and learned, until they remember the Dhamma properly, practice the way of the Dhamma, practice the true way, and walk in the Dhamma. Until after learning from their own teachers, they announce and teach and declare and establish and reveal and expound and explain. Until they can reasonably confute the theories of others that arise and can teach the Dhamma with all its marvels. Until this holy life has become successful, prosperous, widespread, and disseminated among many, until it is well exemplified by humankind. Dhamma, which in Sanskrit is dharma, refers to the body of doctrinal teachings. Indeed, his disciples on the Gangetic plain of northern India, roughly 500 BCE, already numbered in the many thousands by the end of Buddha's life, including those from all walks of life and from every caste, and had in his lifetime even included several kings. Those who, through understanding the Buddha's teachings, and through putting them into practice, had awakened themselves to share the Buddha's awakening, now numbered in the hundreds. He had additionally instituted a well-regulated community of monks, and within a few years, an order of nuns, providing them with a detailed code of conduct, the vinaya, or discipline, setting standards for governance, for maintaining harmony, for relations with lay people, as well as for renunciation of worldly ways, so that future generations might live the holy life. In the years to come, the vast corpus of the Buddha's teachings would be remembered and preserved sometimes reformulated in new cultural contexts, and its civilizing influence would sweep over almost half of the world. Today, hundreds of millions of people still count as sons and daughters of the Buddha, and both monastic communities persist, following the same discipline the Buddha defined 100 generations ago. More importantly, he had set a civilization, a culture of awakening in motion, that alongside many cases of individual awakening would infuse peace, wisdom, and virtue into the broader society. Buddhism is not a revealed religion, that is, of otherworldly origin, communicated through a human prophet to benefit mankind, nor the product of patching together various ancient and obscure sources of wisdom. Rather, it is, particularly in its early form, the product of the single mind, the Buddha's, whose life and being also illustrate and motivate the teachings he espoused. The British scholar of early Buddhism, Richard Gombrich, calls the Buddha the first person. By this he means that we know almost nothing about any prior historical figure anywhere in the world. He is certainly the most influential personality in all of South Asian history. The tale of the Buddha's life has been told many times, sometimes in highly mythical and embellished forms with which the listener may already be familiar. The Noble Search. The Buddha to be grew up in the ancient city of Kapalawattu in the Sakyan Republic in present-day Nepal. He was born of the warrior administrative caste, and his father seems to have had a prominent role in the government of the republic. Moreover, the Buddha tells us of a privileged upbringing as a kind of Nepalese playboy. Bhikkhus, I was delicately nurtured, most delicately nurtured, extremely delicately nurtured. At my father's residence, lotus ponds were made just for my enjoyment. In one of them, blue lotuses bloomed, in another, red lotuses, and in a third, white lotuses. I used no sandalwood unless it came from Kasi, and my headdress, jacket, lower garment, and upper garment were made of cloth from Kasi. By day and by night, a white canopy was held over me, so that cold and heat, dust, grass, and dew would not settle on me. I had three mansions, one for the winter, one for the summer, and one for the rainy season. I spent the 4 months of the rains in the rainy season mansion, being entertained by musicians, none of whom were male, and did not leave the mansion. While in other people's homes, slaves, workers, and servants are given broken rice together with sour gruel for their meals, in my father's residence they were given choice hill rice, meat, and boiled rice. Pretty cushy. His privilege must certainly have also enabled an optimal education, perhaps particularly in statecraft. Yet he was not satisfied with a life of ease and sensual pleasure. As the passage continues, he began reflecting on the inevitability of old age, sickness, and death. Amid such splendor and a delicate life, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, though himself subject to old age, not exempt from old age, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another who is old overlooking his own situation. Now I too am subject to old age and am not exempt from old age. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted
when seeing another who was old, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with youth was completely abandoned.
The exact same passage with regard to old age, youth, is then repeated in this discourse, with regard to illness, health, and then with regard to death and life. Like many of us at a young age, the Buddha experienced an existential crisis, and like the hippies of old, he set off for India on a spiritual quest. Young Gotama became a wandering ascetic.
Here, Adgiwasana, before my awakening, while I was still only an unawakened bodhisatta, I thought, household life is crowded and dusty, life gone forth is wide and open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard and put on the yellow robe and go forth from the home life into homelessness. Later, while still young, a black-haired young man, endowed with the blessing of youth, in the prime of life, though my mother and father wished otherwise and wept with tearful faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness.
A bodhisatta, which in Sanskrit is bodhisattva, awakening being, is a future Buddha, that is one intent on the path to Buddhahood. Gotama's youthful, noble spiritual quest went through three identifiable phases. One, discipleship. Two, extreme austerities. And three, the middle way. The first phase entailed training under an accomplished yogi.
Having gone forth, bhikkhus, in search of what is wholesome, seeking the supreme state of sublime peace, I went to Alara Kamala and said to him, "Friend Kamala, I want to lead the holy life in this Dhamma and discipline."
The Buddha-to-be soon understood the Dhamma of Alara Kamala, as did others, and progressed in his practice. The highest extent to which Kamala declared that he himself entered and dwelt in this Dhamma was the meditative attainment of nothingness. Before long, the Bodhisatta also entered and dwelt in that dimension, but nonetheless realized that
this Dhamma does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening, to nibbana, but only to reappearance in the base of nothingness.
Dissatisfied with that Dhamma, he left. Undaunted, the Buddha-to-be sought out a second teacher, this time one Uddaka Ramaputta, through whom he learned to dwell in the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, but whose Dhamma also did not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to stilling, to direct knowledge, to awakening, nor to nibbana. At this point, the Bodhisatta's period of discipleship came to an end. The second phase of his training was to practice extreme austerities, a way of life common to many homeless mendicants of the time, which he seems to have entered in a way both extreme and austere, and which he describes with some morbid humor.
I thought, suppose I were to take only a little food at a time, only a handful at a time of bean soup, lentil soup, vetch soup, or pea soup. So I took only a little food at a time. My body became extremely emaciated, simply from eating so little My limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. My backside became like a camel's hoof. My spine stood out like a string of beads. My ribs jutted out like the jutting rafters of an old rundown barn. The gleam of my eye appeared to be sunk deep in my eye sockets, like the gleam of water deep in a well. My scalp shriveled and withered like a green bitter gourd, shriveled and withered in the heat and the wind. The skin of my belly became so stuck to my spine that when I thought of touching my belly, I grabbed hold of my spine as well. And when I thought of touching my spine, I grabbed hold of the skin of my belly as well. If I urinated or defecated, I fell over on my face right there. Simply from eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair, rotted at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed, simply from eating so little.
He practiced this way for years, much of this period with five companions in the austerities, but once again became frustrated with the progress he had made. The third phase of his training was the middle way, and he discovered it himself. It is the middle way that would carry him to final awakening. In discovering the middle way, the Buddha seems to have recalled a childhood incident in which he had entered spontaneously into a meditative state, or jhana, and to have considered it to be of pivotal significance. As he recounted,
I recall once when my father, the Sakyan, was working and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, then quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful mental states, I entered and remained in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal accompanied by direct thought and evaluation. Could that be the path to awakening? Then, following on that memory, came the realization, that is the path to awakening. I thought, so why am I afraid of the pleasure that has nothing to do with sensuality, nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities? I thought, I am no longer afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensuality, nothing to do with unskillful mental qualities. But it is not easy to achieve that pleasure with a body so extremely emaciated. Suppose I were to take some solid food, some rice and porridge. So I took some solid food, some rice and porridge.
He would have been familiar with jhanic states of some kind from his training with his two meditation teachers. So we can assume that a critical difference in his childhood experience was that it was fun. He had already abandoned the pursuit of sensual or worldly pleasures in his spiritual quest, and it seems that others had been telling him that all pleasure must be squeezed out of practice and discarded. No pain, no gain. Nevertheless, he had discovered a crack in this understanding that he would pry open to gain access to the middle way. The crack was the difference, previously unnoticed, between worldly pleasure and supramundane pleasure. Likewise, fear of pleasure would no longer be the primary consideration in his dietary habits, but rather keeping the body healthy in order to sustain his practice. Apparently, his five colleagues saw things differently, thinking Gotama had fallen into luxury, and so they left him in a huff. Gotama's awakening. It's reported that the Buddha-to-be sat down at the foot of a Bodhi tree and entered the first level of meditative concentration, jhana, then progressed to the second, to the third, and to the fourth and final. He describes the unfolding of his awakening as follows.
When the mind was thus collected, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, pliant, malleable, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of recollecting my past lives. I recollected my manifold past lives, that is, one birth, two, five, 10, 50, 100, 1,000, 100,000, many eons of cosmic contraction, many eons of cosmic expansion, many eons of cosmic contraction and expansion. There I had such a name, belonged to such a clan, had such an appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such the end of my life. Passing away from that state, I rearose there. There too I had such a name, belonged to such a clan, had such an appearance. Such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such the end of my life. Passing away from that state, I rearose here. Thus I remembered my manifold past lives in their modes and details. This was the first knowledge I attained in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was destroyed, knowledge arose, darkness was destroyed, light arose, as happens in one who is heedful, ardent, and resolute.
This is clearly a direct recognition that the present life is one link in a long and monotonous continuum of death and rebirth, what is known as samsara, faring on. In more concrete terms, we can also think of samsara as stuckness in normal existence, the inability to free ourselves from the recurring patterns of thinking and responding from the soap opera of life. Rebirth was not a universally accepted notion at the time of the Buddha, but was presented by him as a conceptual context for Buddhist practice. We'll see in later talks that awakening entails a break from the cycle.
When the mind was thus collected, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, pliant, malleable, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of beings. I saw by means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human, beings passing away and reappearing, and I discerned how they are inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate in accordance with their karma. These beings who were endowed with bad conduct of body, speech, and mind, who reviled the noble ones, held wrong views, and undertook actions under the influence of wrong views, with the breakup of the body after death, have reappeared in the plane of deprivation, the bad destination, the lower realms in hell. But these beings, who were endowed with good conduct of body, speech, and mind, who did not revile the noble ones, who held right views and undertook actions under the influence of right views, with the breakup of the body after death, have reappeared in the good destinations in the heavenly world. Thus, by means of the divine eye, purified and surpassing the human, I saw beings passing away and reappearing, and I discerned how they are inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, in accordance with their karma. This was the second knowledge I attained in the second watch of the night. Ignorance was destroyed, knowledge arose, darkness was destroyed, light arose, as happens in one who is heedful, ardent, and resolute.
This recognizes that samsara generalizes to all beings and that our past actions, kamma, or Sanskrit karma, determine the circumstances of our rebirths. We build in this life through our ethical choices the house that we will live in the next. But our choices will also serve to end this process. If the first two knowledges are cosmological in nature, the last is psychological, in that it provides an introspective view of what happens in the process of awakening.
When the mind was thus collected, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of defilement, pliant, malleable, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to the knowledge of the ending of the mental fermentations. I discerned, as it had come to be, that this is suffering, this is the origination of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. These are the taints, this is the origination of taints, this is the cessation of taints, this is the way leading to the cessation of taints. My heart, thus knowing, thus seeing, was released from the taint of sensuality, released from the taint of becoming, released from the taint of ignorance. With release, there was the knowledge, released. I discerned that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done, there is nothing further for this world. This was the third knowledge I attained in the third watch of the night. Ignorance was destroyed, knowledge arose, darkness was destroyed, light arose, as happens in one who is heedful, ardent, and resolute.
The third knowledge makes implicit reference to the Four Noble Truths, which we will revisit in later talks, as well as to the taints of sensuality, becoming, and ignorance. We will learn later that the Buddha regarded mind in terms of networks of mutually conditioning mental factors. Upon awakening, Gotama is said to have uttered the following verse, oft recited to this day.
Through the round of many births, I roamed without reward, without rest, seeking the house builder. Painful is birth again and again. House builder, you're seen. You will not build a house again. All your rafters are broken, the ridgepole destroyed, gone to the unconditioned. The mind has come to the end of craving.
The house builder is to be found in our own minds. Once we find him, he will not provide us with a new home in samsara. Gotama had discovered the deathless, the end of suffering, the extinguishing of the flame, which is what nibbana means. Henceforth, he would be known as the Bhagava, the blessed or fortunate one, Buddha, the awakened one, Sammasambuddha, the perfectly awakened, and Tathagata, the such gone. What is awakening? By the end of these talks, we'll be in a much better position to appreciate that it entails a radical rework of human cognitive faculties. For now, we can roughly understand it as the perfection of human character in three aspects. the perfection of virtue, the perfection of equanimity, and the perfection of wisdom. The awakened person is virtuous, selfless, kind, compassionate, actively concerned with the well-being of all beings. The awakened person is equanimous, unruffled by the contingencies of the world, experiencing neither lust nor aversion nor fear, but rather blissfully content in all circumstances. The awakened person is wise, able to see things as they really are, unbiased, unprejudiced, without fixed views. It will be appreciated that these three aspects are mutually supporting. None can be perfected without perfecting the other two. The awakened person has mastered the skill of life. Someone who shares the Buddha's awakening is also called an arahant, worthy one. Although the arahant realizes what the Buddha realized, the Buddha is much more. He is the discoverer and teacher of the path to awakening, upon which the awakening of others has been grounded ever since. Thank you.